Long Reads is brought to you in association with Pluto Press. Pluto have developed a new list of audiobooks for some of their most popular titles. The Brutish Museums by Dan Hicks is one audiobook you can buy from Pluto. The New York Times described it as one of the best art books of the year, and it spurred a number of museums to return stolen artifacts. You can order The Brutish Museums now by going to tiny.one/Jacobin. Hello, you're very welcome to Long Reads, a Jacobin podcast where we look in depth at political topics and thinkers. My name's Daniel Finn, I'm the features editor here at Jacobin, and I'll be presenting the show. It's now 50 years since a group of Native Americans and their supporters occupied a small village called Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Wounded Knee was the site of a notorious massacre by the US cavalry in the 19th century. Local leaders and civil rights activists called in the American Indian Movement, or AIM, to support the occupation. Vernon Bellecourt, one of the AIM leaders, spoke to reporters at the time.
We have exhausted our diplomatic efforts. We have negotiated, we have pleaded, our people have been going to Washington for years, and nothing changes. The conditions get worse. So what is happening in Wounded Knee, when a declaration of sovereignty was made, it's a start. It's a start of a revolution amongst Indian people today, not only a revolution that's taking place within our own existing tribal form of government on the reservations, but we recognize that we have to take a position of sovereignty in relationship to the treaties. A sovereign treaty or a congressionally ratified treaties was made with Indian nations as sovereign people. And it's really immoral at this time to suggest that in negotiating those treaties that we should play it by their ground rules within their judicial system, within their courts. We have never gotten a fair shake there in any area. The Ogallala people in particular have seen the corruption, the theft against their lands, the leasing policy of that particular government in Pine Ridge has totally failed their people. While the bureaucracy gets stronger and they can buy more guns and buy more police cars and other type of equipment, and the people, the reservation people, the Indian people are still suffering with a 42-year life expectancy. We're still suffering a 3 times the national average infant mortality rate and a 5 times the national average suicide rate. Chronic ill health and diseases yet prevail in reservations that have cured in the white world. So when we can see these kinds of conditions, we recognize that the system has totally failed us, and now we should have the right to total self-determination, which our interpretation is total self-government. And this is it's a whole new attitude being created at Wounded Knee and will continue to become a reality.
The occupation resulted in a siege that pitted AIM against U.S. Marshals, the FBI, and a private militia known as the Goons. It also inspired a wave of international support and solidarity. Our producer, Connor Gillies, spoke to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz about the legacy of the Wounded Knee Uprising. She's a veteran activist and the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States.
Here we are 50 years later. What do you see as the significance and legacy of the Wounded Knee occupation?
Yeah, it's quite a trajectory. It's hard to believe it's been a half a century ago. But it had such incredible repercussions, not only in the United States, Native American colonized reservations and urban Indians, but also was inspirational to other places. And it started as a really local thing, you know, trying to oust the horrible chairman. Mm. At Pine Ridge, it was really dictatorial and persecuting. AIM had been founded in Minneapolis, you know, not in Lakota country, but it started spreading all over the, it was founded in 1968, so it started spreading around the country. And obviously Pine Ridge became quite a center as well as Standing Rock. And so this awful chairman who had a group of armed thugs. So it was kind of a civil war going on, lots of shooting, you know, between these armed thugs and...
Yeah, this is the Goon Squad.
Yeah, the Goon Squad. And, of course, the FBI was, you know, had a role in all that. And this was the period, you know, it was kind of the end of the 60s, but AIM was founded in that milieu of, you know, the like Panther Party and Puerto Rican liberation movement and the women's movement. So all of this, you know, this had really affected the whole country. There was really a revolutionary period. So by 1973, it was, thanks to the FBI and the Nixon administration, a lot of it had been suppressed.
In 2016, during protests at Standing Rock, Democracy Now! Spoke with Oglala Lakota activist and water protector Deborah Whiteplume about conditions that led to the uprising.
The Indian Reorganization Act government, which is an act of Congress in place in 1934, governs most Native nations in the United States. While our IRA government at that time was very oppressive to Lakota people, they were keeping us from having jobs or homes or whatever few services the federal government provided because we held on to the Lakota way of life. And we also wanted to reclaim not only our identity but our lands and the care of our land and the responsibility of caring for our land. And at that time, the tribal president was Dick Wilson, and he had been working with the federal government to sign away 1/8 of our homeland to the federal government. And it just happened to be where there was a lot of what the fat taker calls resources, and they want to mine it, you know, coal, gas, oil, uranium, whatever it may be, water. And so we put up a ruckus, and we said, no, you're not going to do that because our coming generations need that. And so there were a lot of shootouts and armed struggle going on in those days. And in the so-called border towns around us, which we call occupied territory, Indians were getting killed, and their murderers were not being held for justice. They were, like, charged with the lowest felony there could be, doing 2 years of probation, and it was just enough was enough. You know, it was a moment in time. There was a women's movement, there was a civil rights movement, there was the Vietnam War stuff going on, and we just said, that's enough for us too. We're not going to take this anymore, and we stood up and we fought. You know, we had to fight our own government, and they called in the FBI and the marshals and the army. Basically, it was a military occupation of our homeland.
Well, there was a lot of real oppression going on, and a backlash, you know, of oppression and calling this peace terrorists. You know, the AIM was number two after the Black Panther Party as a domestic terrorist organization. So that just gave the FBI full reign to do anything they wanted to, infiltrate, you know, kill, everything. So they really got, you know, the elderly traditional people really began organizing themselves because it was their children who were in AIM, mostly getting killed, getting injured, threatened, and even themselves, you know, their houses being bombed, you know, with the Molotov cocktails and all. So there's a real terrorism going on. And so they met at this hall, a community center, and decided to go to Wounded Knee. So that was the beginning. And then it's just amazing observing it. You know, I was here in San Francisco when we had an AIM Bay Area Council. And so everyone started organizing to, you know, send blankets, to send help, and, you know, this whole network developed around the country. It was an incredible solidarity. Even some rather conservative, more conservative Native groups or competitive ones, like the National Indian Youth Council, who had a lot of criticisms of AIM being too militant and attracting problems, you know, and of course Nixon went full on Vietnam, you know, sending tanks and the army and the National Guard flying overhead. And so it not only had national attention, but hemispheric among Native people and in the Pacific, Aborigines and Hawaiian Natives. And And Europeans got very interested in it and were sending money, sending support. It was in all the newspapers. So I think, you know, what came of it that is lasting and permanent is just really remarkable, because they made this pivot after it ended. They were pretty devastated. On the other hand, AIM was pretty devastated. It was a long, hard slog, you know, the occupation. There were all these trials, and that's where I got involved, actually, as a legal advisor, even though I was a historian with a PhD, but I'd gone to law school for a couple of years, but giving expert testimony, mainly working with the legal team. And it was really remarkable how in July 1974, really just a little over a year after the uprising, they formed an international organization, the International Indian Treaty Council. Their goal was to take their 1868 treaty, the Great Sioux Nation Treaty of 1868, which was to establish forever this much larger territory than they have now, that covered all of South Dakota, most of North Dakota, some of Montana and Nebraska, and had full access to the Missouri River. And that was their main summer grounds. And that was to be forever. And, of course, it just got eaten away by illegally opening it up to settlement, then allotting the land. And it narrowed down to these little islands separated from each other, island of seven reservations. And some UN people, by the way, came as representatives to the human rights people, came to South Dakota during the uprising. So they built these links with the UN and with non-governmental organizations, human rights organizations. And that very quickly, they formed the International Indian Treaty Council. They had 5,000 in attendance.
Wow.
And representatives from Latin America, Native peoples, and from Australia, New Zealand, Hawaii. And they held it at all AIM conferences. To this day, they have annual conferences, the International Indian Treaty Council auspices. And it's always on Indian grounds, you know, outside tents and all. I've gone to a couple of them. They're just amazing two-week meetings where it's the only democracy I've ever witnessed. Are these conferences where they make unanimous decisions, but they argue, they come to conclusions, they don't vote. It just emerges, you know, if you discuss things long enough. It's sort of like diplomacy, you know.
Yeah. Wounded Knee was chosen for its historical significance as the site of the last massacre of the Indian Wars in 1890. Up to that point, you write about how the Ocheti Sakowi had never been defeated by the U.S. Army and, in fact, dealt the U.S. Army great losses, like at the Battle of Greasy Grass. But this massacre in 1890, what led to that extreme violence, and how did that fit into the general aims of the United States government at that time?
Yeah, they never lost the war, but the U.S. Army, not just for, you know, the Lakota, Dakotas, but and all their campaigns, the Apaches, the Navajos, you know, in Northern California. These were undeclared wars from the founding. Of course, they had cleared the colonies, you know, under the British and forced out the people, less genocidal because the Native people fought, but they pushed them into the peripheries. And then, of course, declared independence. And during that 10 years between declaration and the Constitution, they weren't mainly fighting the British. They were mainly fighting the Native people. And, of course, right. The textbooks say that the British were using the Indians. You know, the Indians were definitely taking advantage, but they were fighting on their own. They were winning. But that's when the genocide began. The really just kill every standing Indian, and then making treaties that were forced treaties, like the removal treaties that removed these five agricultural civilizations that were like Mesoamerica. They had come from Mesoamerica and built this civilization, this powerful civilization, and forcing them to go to, you know, reservation or territories, they called it then, in Indian Territory in Oklahoma. So that was, you know, these forced marches. This occurred between 1830 and 1850. And then they really took off, you know, after the Plains Indians, after they had conquered up to the Mississippi. And so even during the Civil War, they were having incursions. And, of course, the same generals in the Civil War, the Union generals, were very, and the soldiers were very seasoned from 4 years of war. And they had also developed weapons like the Winchester rifle, rapid-fire rifle, and the Hotchkiss, you know, cannon that hadn't existed in earlier Indian wars. So it was more equal fighting. And so they went for the civilians. You know, actually, when the men, the young men, would go out hunting, they would kill people in the villages, and elders were there because, you know, they weren't on the hunt or whatever. So this was just massacre after massacre. Yeah, they never, ever lost a engagement where they were engaged on horseback and fighting. They mainly, especially after the great loss, you know, the Custer battle and the complete loss, they really pulled away from war and just went to genocide. So the effect that had on the Lakota were, you know, so many people killed and leaders killed, like Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull assassinated. It was Sitting Bull who actually somehow made his way to Nevada. And there's a, because they heard of a, of Wovoka, a holy man of the Paiute who had come up with this ghost dance. Supposedly this ghost dance, if it danced and danced, the dead warriors, you know, the people, because they were also, you know, out there massacring. They had subdued the people in Northern California and Nevada. So they would come back to life in this ghost dance. So they were dancing with their dead relatives. It's interesting. So he took it back to Pine Ridge and taught the people how the only... One of the things the army did was always take the sacred items from the native people. They would always first kill the medicine people. They had spies. They would get identify who is the, you know, like Sitting Bull, who is the spiritual person. He wasn't a warrior. He was a spiritual leader who went along, you know, with the army. So they targeted these people who were the link with their entire culture, you know, and society. So they lost all their items, you know, their sacred items and their sacred leaders. And Sitting Bull, still alive, he brought this ghost dance back, that this was worth a try. So people started dancing like 24/7 until they would fall, but other dancers would come out, and, you know, while they were on the ground sleeping, and they would then get up and dance. And all they had to have, they didn't have to have any sacred objects, just a calico shirt. You see, the AIM people wore those with ribbons, colorful ribbons, and then just their clothes. You know, they didn't have to have any regalia of any kind or any sacred objects for the ghost dance. And so that's what the army was afraid of, that they were disarmed. They were under occupation. The army surrounded them. And yet they saw fit to see this as a threat. And so that was the Wounded Knee Massacre, where they came in. And it was when Sitting Bull was bringing down his people to Pine Ridge to the Ghost Dance. And then, you know, he was killed by the army. And then they had that engagement. So that was, you know, the tragedy of Wounded Knee, that the really had been kind of course, the elders never forgot, but the boarding schools and all, this wasn't taught, and they were taken from their families. So as other generations came, they really didn't know what had happened. So I think that was the that terrible period when the Native population was reduced from 10 million when the Europeans came to 500,000 in the continent. If that is not genocide, I don't know what is. So they were so reduced in numbers. And then other things happened. You know, the, of course, allotment happened in there. And then they gave Indian voting rights in 1924. They were trying to make individual citizens, U.S. citizens, out of them, sort of, you know, by boarding schools and voting and all. So this was a terrible period between 1890 and post-World War II. But they were organizing. They had organizations, and they went constantly, not just them, but, you know, by then the Pueblos and, you know, all the Native people had constantly taken delegations to Washington, D.C. So it's not like they were without any movement or power. In 1954, in the period of the McCarthy era, that very repressive era, Congress made a law to do away with Native people entirely and create them, you know, just as individuals to get them off the reservation. So they started with a reservation in Washington state, and it became, you know, the land became theirs, but as private owners, so they no longer had Native status. And then the Menominee, and that's when, well, the National Indian Youth Council, mm-hmm. The National Council of American Indians, to fight this, you know, fight privatization of the reservations. So that spurred the movement. And then in 1968, the more militant Native American movement that was more on the lines of the Black Panther Party, you know, founded in Minneapolis. But there were many organizations.
Indians of All Tribes, the Mohawk Warrior Society, the editorial collective Akwesasne Notes, and the United American Indians of New England were just a few other organizations resisting post-war termination and pressing the treaty issue. AIM co-founder Clyde Bellecourt was one of the leaders giving voice to this new Red Power movement surging in the wake of the fissions.
The system was forcing them back and forth, forcing them off the reservation because they were starving, forcing them out of the cities because they could receive no justice here.
He delivered this convocation speech to Augsburg University in the early 70s.
When we formed the American Indian Movement, we knew that we were going to do something about that. We had become known as a very militant organization. But nobody knows about the things that the American Indian Movement has done. Nobody knows about the Indian Studies courses that have been instituted right here at the University of Minnesota in McAllister. Nobody knows about the housing program that was created by AIM. Over 2,000 families were helped in 1 year. Nobody knows of the Legal Rights Center. They say it's militant to do these things. It's militant to stand up.
Around this time, the Wounded Knee Massacre and its history was becoming better known. Dee Brown's best-selling book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee was published in 1970. 2 years later, the band Redbone released this song, We Were All Wounded at Wounded Knee. Dee Brown's book was released shortly after news had broken out about the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War.
100 Americans stormed into the hamlet, drove all the residents out of their huts, then opened fire with automatic weapons.
Groups like AIM immediately drew comparisons. At Wounded Knee, people spoke of the similarities between what was going on in Vietnam and in Lakota country to suppress the native population, both in the propping up of a puppet government and in the actual weaponry being used. I asked Roxanne about the links between the anti-war and indigenous movements.
AIM put out a poster that I still have a copy of, which at the bottom has the scene from the Wounded Knee Massacre, the burial, and the My Lai, the trenches with dead people. And it was a very powerful, you know, very powerful image. The anti-war movement was waning, you know, after the treaty was signed, you know, that the U.S. would get out in 1972. I think only Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden were still, you know, trouncing around the country, you know, trying to keep things going. But it was, you know, basically people kind of think, well, the war's over, you know, because there was no more draft. There was no more sending more troops. It was just a stalemate thing. And so there was not much of an anti-war movement by, but people who had been very involved in the anti-war movement, there was a tremendous amount of solidarity. Here in San Francisco, they had the American Indians. There used to be American Indian centers all over, and most of them have closed now. Mm. By 1973, Wounded Knee, there were tens of thousands of Native people in Phoenix and San Francisco, Los Angeles, Denver, Chicago. These were relocation sites where they provided support, not very good support. But Russell Means, who became an important leader in the American Indian Movement and the Treaty Council, was his idea. And he was working at one of these relocation, I think in Indiana. Oh, it was one of the relocation places. And he joined AIM, you know, and would walk around with an AIM flag and became, you know, then he got involved in the, because he was from Pine Ridge. The people who really started it were Dennis Banks and the Bellacourt brothers, and they're Ojibwe from Minnesota. So it was, you know, it's interesting. AIM was really founded by Ojibwes, but very quickly the Lakotas got involved. And yeah, so support of the anti-war people, there was, you know, at the Wounded Knee itself, there was this re-energizing people who had, you know, worn out. A lot of people really burned out by 1973 from great losses, you know, and just not really being able to end the Vietnam War. And it's a kind of dark period, and also when right-wing groups were beginning to form, and seriously, you know, the white nationalists. And so this, and a part of that was Wounded Knee, you know, a reaction to Wounded Knee. The Second Amendment Foundation formed in Washington State and turned into, you know, a white nationalist organization, because this brought out the pioneer spirit, you know, in a lot of Anglo settlers, descendants that, the Indians.
I'm thinking of Douglas Durham going on tour with the John Birch Society.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah, he was definitely, you know, placed there. He'd been a policeman somewhere and was very clever. You know, he got, AIM never had, you know, it was not an entity at that time with any kind of nonprofit status. It depended on Marlon Brando and others for, you know, for donations. And they didn't have a list. There was no list of AIM participants, you know, AIM members. There was no such thing as AIM membership. It was a movement. They insisted it's the American Indian Movement, not an organization. And that really worked in their favor because it made it hard, you know, for the FBI to identify. But Durham, he's probably sent in there for this purpose, was to develop a membership role, that it would be much more efficient, you know, and as they were, especially the International Indian Treaty Council was founded, he was there, you know, he was one of the main people there from AIM, and it was there that he talked them into membership. And so he was able to get names, addresses, phone numbers, everything, because he was in charge of the membership. So that was his role, and it was, you know, really devastating.
COINTELPRO officially ended in 1971, but events on Pine Ridge between 72 and 76 suggest that only the name had changed. Over those years, also known as the Reign of Terror, over 60 AIM members and supporters were murdered, and many more attacked, often at the hands of Wilson's goon squad. One former leader of that paramilitary force claimed the FBI had supplied intelligence and arms. At the very least, FBI agents turned a blind eye to the attacks. The FBI tried to discredit and disrupt AIM by manufacturing media stories, manipulating evidence, and coercing witnesses against Leonard Peltier, for example. Then to wreak havoc internally, the Bureau used infiltrators and agent provocateurs, like Douglas Durham. They gathered information, preyed on divisions, cultivated paranoia, and built suspicion around particular organizers, like Anime Aquash, Mi'kmaq from Nova Scotia. In a statement from 1975, Aquash accused the Bureau of engaging in political warfare against socialists, MLK, Fred Hampton, and now the American Indian Movement. Anime Aquash was found murdered in 1976, almost certainly as a result of the distrust sowed by the FBI. Jack Schwartz, a defense lawyer, suspected that the Bureau was more directly responsible, though a 2014 article by the New York Times Magazine suggests someone in AIM ultimately pulled the trigger. Here's Schwartz in a 1978 broadcast for KPFA.
They had a campaign to neutralize and destroy the American Indian Movement. And as part of that campaign was a heavy program of provocateurs, of trying to incite violence on reservations. Most of the time that doesn't make news because the only people who die because of the provocation are Indian people. I mentioned before Anime Aquash, who was one of our defense witnesses. She was killed either by or at the behest of the FBI, February of 1976. It's an interesting case in that the FBI found her body, cut off her hands and fingers, sent them to Washington, D.C., buried her under a false name at Pine Ridge Reservation, had a doctor from Nebraska list on the autopsy sheet that Anna Mae had died of exposure. We brought the body up because we didn't believe that. The weather had been very mild on the reservation that year. We brought the body up, and she had a gaping hole behind her left ear, and we had the medical examiner for St. Paul come in and examine the body. He said that she was shot at point-blank range, the back of her head, by either a .32 or a .38. The attorneys were followed. There were wiretaps. There were burglaries of our offices. There were infiltrators put into our law offices. Unfortunately, it's a very common thing to suspend the Constitution on Indian land and reservations. Indian people are hauled through the system, are interrogated at gunpoint very often, their relatives are threatened, their families are threatened, and so on. These are similar tactics they used against the anti-war movement, the student movement, the Chicano movement, the black movement, the women's movement, the labor unions, where they will infiltrate, they will provoke violence, they will frame people, throw them in jail, and so on and so forth. It doesn't begin and doesn't end with the Indian movement.
When Doug Durham was outed, he joined the right-wing anti-communist John Birch Society, and on press tours, he promoted an image of AIM being violent and criminal, which was reflected widely in the media.
I mean, by the time they discovered him, he had already done the deed, you know, that he was put there for. In my opinion, I don't know if everyone agrees with that, but I think that was his role. So that was, you know, that really brought a lot of arrests and detentions and of people who weren't really doing anything. So yeah, it how it's affected the present is just, you know, it's manifest in the Treaty Council, but also many other organizations now, and I think they don't necessarily trace themselves to AIM. But I think that uprising is just, you know, Alcatraz was one step in that, and that was, you know, really a lot of different, mainly urban Native people from relocation. But it had its limitations because it was simply an occupation, and AIM was founded that year, but they were not, you know, they were not the leadership of the occupation. They were out there, many of the individuals out there, but they hadn't really organized enough yet to be a force. So that picked up, you know, really AIM picked up its organizing. Alcatraz had it was a good booster to that.
You got involved with AIM's international work following the uprising at Wounded Knee. What were the main goals of that work and the International Indian Treaty Council?
They first organized a conference. This was 1974. They got the non-governmental organization credentials to do work at the UN as non-governmental people. And immediately, the International Indian Treaty Council spawned many other organizations getting credentials, you know, as NGOs representing different tribes or different regions around the world eventually. There was a South American organization, CISA, the Andean organization, Amazonian one. So they organized this conference with the very seasoned NGOs in Geneva, Switzerland, where the human rights, everything to do with human rights and decolonization takes place at the UN Center in Geneva, Switzerland. A very expensive place to do political work, but I am the most expensive city in the world. But there was so much. The other thing that popped up at that time was an organization of just Geneva citizens who organized solidarity groups and provided housing, meals, and just really incredible. So I don't think any other group in the world has ever had such a welcoming as this. And they had this kind of mythological, although true, thing of this Haudenosaunee elder was sent by the Haudenosaunee. This is the Iroquois Confederacy of upstate New York and all the way up to Montreal, Tiscaya. And he went to the League of Nations. They sent him to the League of Nations. And he wasn't able to get in, but he stayed the full length of the existence of the League of Nations trying. And the Geneva people took him in and supported him. And it's in all their school books and everything. So that's, you know, it was all kind of just magical how this happened. And I witnessed it. I was involved. After the founding of the Treaty Council, I got involved. I had nothing to do with helping found it. I got involved in the fall with the legal team, and the course of Vine Deloria recruited me. And so that's when I really met, you know, the leaders of Wounded Knee and also what they were doing. And I thought that sounded, I mean, I didn't personally have much faith in the UN either, but what they were proposing, it just sounded so innovative and important, and it has been, because the Treaty Council not only has spawned all these other organizations, but it has grown. They set up first a working group. We got a working group by 1982 and a subcommission on racism, a very low level. But that working group became infamous, you know, or famous, and drew a lot of attention. But interestingly enough, it was when the horrible genocide in Guatemala was taking place, 1982, 81, 82. And Rigoberta Menchú was in exile as a representative of the Mayan people, traveling a lot. She was sponsored a lot by the World Council of Churches and other organizations, and she just happened to be there for the first meeting of the working group, and she was world famous. She just published her autobiography. She was a celebrity. So this gave a attention, you know, to her testimony was absolutely, it just broke your heart, you know, the things that her whole family had been murdered. And so this is a very powerful beginning, and the working group really then attracted, you know, lots of attention, like no other working group in the UN. And then eventually built up to an assembly, establishing an assembly that would then, it had no real effect at UN headquarters because it was all within the human rights, stayed within human rights. So expanding to the to headquarters. The Cubans were really helpful to us. I mean, amazingly helpful. And they just were very, very good in the UN work. And they were also kind of teaching the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, you know, how to lobby, how to get into the delegates' lounge and everything. So that I transmitted. I did a lot of that UN work as we built up a working group there at UN headquarters. And so it, you know, we had a big conference at the UN in 1993. And then now at every year, there's a UN conference on Native Americans. And it's every April at headquarters. When I was there, I've only gone to one, 2014. I couldn't believe it. There were 15,000 people came to that first UN conference from all over the hemisphere, yeah. Also from Africa. We had, you know, really spread out. And now it's about, I don't even know, 30,000. I think there were 100,000 one year, every 10 days every April. New York turned over to indigenous peoples. And so they've accomplished a great deal, you know. It's just a major force at the international level now. So, and then we got a declaration on the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples through General Assembly. At first, Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Great Britain voted against it, and we didn't need their votes, you know, because we got the majority, but it was embarrassing.
You mentioned Clyde Bellecourt, but there's a great story where in the 80s he went to visit Ireland to support families of fallen hunger strikers. What were some of the other ways AIM and the IITC were building international solidarity?
Well, yeah, the Irish connection is so important. These were the key non-Indian supporters. It goes back to the Irish famine period, you know, before the great leaving, you know, the millions who came on hunger ships, that the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma, they heard about or read about the famine in Ireland, and they collected money from their membership. And it wasn't much, you know, maybe a few $100. And they wired it to them. I don't know how they probably, I have no idea how they got the connections to do that. But it's a part of now Irish Republican lore of the Choctaw support. They also wrote a letter that, you know, said that they felt brotherhood, you know, of what they had suffered, that the Irish were now suffering. So it goes back to that, literally the 1840s of this sense of a tie. And, you know, really the Irish were the indigenous peoples of Ireland when they were invaded by Britain. Mm-hmm. Before it invaded the U.S., the British used you know, their experiment with settler colonialism in Ireland to, you know, conquer the United States. So this tie is very important. And there are, you know, Irish solidarity groups that still exist and still organize things. But that visit, Clyde's visit, really, again, you know, reminded people of that solidarity. So this was, and Irish were, you know, during the troubles, so-called, the IRA, but also Irish support groups formed in the United States, and they were just instinctively, you know, in solidarity with the American Indian movement, and there used to be meetings together, sort of died down, you know, a little bit. The situation still exists in Northern Ireland, but...
Yeah, sure.
And there are other links. In 2004, the Dakota activist, actor, and musician Floyd Red Crow Westerman sent this message of solidarity to representatives of Sinn Féin.
Me talk yappy, my relatives in Ireland. Chazemita kankiduta Dakota oyate himiyelo. We are all in a struggle in this world. And I'm very happy to have lived in this time, to have met some of the great leaders of your people. It was my honor to be part of bringing our drum over there with our kids in our survival school. And I remember the day we were singing the drum outside of Armagh prison. And British troops came and put the guns on us and told us to leave, and we didn't even move. What were they going to do right there? But we finished our song. And that song rang out through that prison, I understand, to everybody in there. And then when I learned of the Gaelic language, of their slogan, Chucky Arla, we will have our day. I think our struggles are common, and that in the name of Chucky Arla, Mitakuyasin, it's the same. We will have our day too.
In the 90s, Irish politician Michael Ferguson offered his own words of support.
Greetings to the native people of America. It's 500 years since Columbus first came to Ireland, and as a consequence of that, you have had 500 years of terrible struggle, attempting to assert your national rights, your integrity, and your way of life. It is my hope that one day, both the Native Irish and the Native American will meet as nations, as free nations, as free Native peoples among the nations of the world.
During the 70s, AIM members visited Ulster, and Irish Republicans raised funds for defendants facing trial after the Wounded Knee occupation. During the 1981 hunger strike in Northern Ireland, AIM leader Leonard Peltier, who was then also in prison, fasted in solidarity. The International Indian Treaty Council welcomed representatives of the Irish struggle, including Bernadette Devlin. CBS profiled her in 1970.
The people in this area have never been allowed to march for the much more important things, mm-hmm. like jobs for the people of this area, mm-hmm. like houses, the right to some kind of control over their own lives and not always be dictated to, not always treated as scum on two bases, on the basis, one, that they're disloyal, and on the second and more important basis, that they're working class people.
Devlin had recently completed a tour of the United States, where she castigated Irish Americans who opposed civil rights, made connections with the Black Panther Party, and spoke out in support of the indigenous occupation of Alcatraz Island. I read a bit about meetings with the Zimbabwean African National Union, Puerto Rican Socialist Party, more examples of building those international connections. What were those meetings about?
Well, one of the planning meetings, conferences, you know, one of the annual conferences of the International Indian Treaty Council, the one in Lakpala, in, you know, a Lakota reservation in South Dakota, right on the Missouri River, the leadership was able to get UN diplomats from Zimbabwe and I think ANC, yeah, the ANC, the African National Congress, to send someone to the conference. So that was wonderful. It was also an Australian Aborigine who was invited. This was like 1975. And that was memorable. I was there. I didn't go to many of those treaty conferences, but I was at that one. And it just really blew me away, you know, the solidarity and the felt resonance of the Africans for, you know, because they were colonized and shipped many, you know, shipped abroad all over the Western Hemisphere. So there was that really, really strong tie. And that has, it was much more radical in the 70s because they were just getting independence and in fighting. And actually, it was the ZAPU representative because Zimbabwe didn't yet exist till 1982. They had ZANU and ZAPU, and this was the one linked more to Soviet aid, and the other was more with Chinese aid. But So he was a representative of the independence movement. The Puerto Rican Socialist Party almost always, I think even still, sends representatives to conferences. There's really strong bonds, still a strong feeling, you know, and knowledge.
In the 1980s, when the Reagan administration led a proxy war against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, it was the indigenous Miskito people who were caught in the crossfire. PBS investigated the situation on the northern border with Honduras for a 1987 episode of Frontline, interviewing the former Contra leader, Edgar Chamorro.
November 16th, 1981, the day the choice is made to deal with Nicaragua by force. These are the forces to do it, an army organized and equipped by the American government. They're known as the counter-revolutionaries, or Contras.
The Contras are coming. They're at the crossroads, and they killed a young guy. We couldn't spend the night at home last night. We couldn't even take sheets or blankets with us. We had to sleep out last night, and we're just now heading back to our village.
By early 1982, a war has begun in Nicaragua. The action then is described by a former Contra leader.
They were making small incursions, hit and run things. And it was just to attack isolated places or kill a border guard or harass people in a farm, or things like that.
The border between Nicaragua and its neighbor, Honduras, where the Contras are based, becomes a war zone. The Sandinistas declare a state of emergency and begin to remove peasants from villages in the area. That includes the brutal relocation of the Miskito Indians, providing the Contras with a growing supply of recruits.
Many of the people at that time were mostly peasants. Some of them have also their own grievances against the Sandinistas. Sandinistas made many mistakes. They mishandled the minority groups in the East Coast. So those people became very anti-government and ready to fight. And then others were also brought by force, intimidated, or they are put in a position they have no choice.
How does that work?
Well, it works, for instance, a commander goes to a town in Nicaragua or close to the border, and then he says, who are here Sandinista supporters? Then they identify two or three. He shuts them in public. Then he asks the rest, do you want to follow me? Well, most people follow them.
Roxanne spent years in the region in her capacity as a human rights activist, and later recounted this time in a memoir, Blood on the Border.
It gets complicated around the Contra War, and we have that terrible story of it. The United States government and these neoconservatives like Elliot Abrams and John Bolton using indigenous rights in a really cynical way to bolster their case for regime change in Nicaragua. It was greatly damaging to AIM leadership, but you know, you were there on the Miskito Coast fighting to bring nuance to this really complicated issue. What would you say was missing from the conversation there on both sides?
Boy, that was a terrible time. You know, it's like 8 years of my life, mostly down there and in Honduras. It was really a terrible split. You know, there have been other splits in AIM. There was a lot of tension between the Bellacourts and Russell Means and the Oklahoma group. You know, there was, like any organization, there were tensions, but nothing like what happened in the 80s over the Mezquita. And it was so complex. I mean, in San Francisco, I'd really supported the Sandinista. But once they won, I was still going to UN meetings, but I just, you know, I said, okay, Nicaragua's fine now. You know, they don't need me anymore. And I saw this tiny little piece in the Albuquerque Journal that said Mezquita's armed clash with the Sandinistas on the Atlantic coast. And, well, I knew the Mezquitos because, you know, the representatives of them before the Sandinista Revolution, they came to the first Geneva meeting, three representatives. And I knew them, and they had an organization, and I liked them. You know, they were fine. So I thought, you know, I wondered, because it named Misurasata, which was their organization, that it was a clash, Misurasata and the Sandinistas. And then I was in New York. I was still going to New York, to the UN a lot, and this ambassador arranged for me to go on a delegation he had organized of trade unionists. I think there were 10 of us or so, and that we would get a sense of what the Sandinistas were doing and to meet them, you know, before I went out there. Mezquitas fled across the river. You know, they're divided. It's a divided nation. It was under Somoza that he allowed the World Court to change the Honduran-Nicaraguan line to put it up at the, you know, the Coco River. So half the Mezquita Nation lived in Honduras and half lived in Nicaragua. And once there were tensions, the Hondurans, who were at that time, we called them a stationary submarine for the United States. You know, they were the ones hosting the Contras, and it's a very corrupt government. So they closed down the border because they didn't want these Nicaraguan Mezquitos to come in. So I flew out. They had this rickety little plane that had been a 1940s, I think, or 50s color plane that the U.S. left there. And God, I flew on those so much. I can't believe I survived the airplanes there, but... So they took me out to Puerto Cabezas to meet with the comandante there. And then he arranged for two Mezquitos men to drive me up to the border to visit the villages so I could see that they weren't being oppressed or, you know, they weren't occupied by the army. And indeed, we went, you know, on the boat on that river and visited all these villages. And I met people. So this was in the summer of 1981. I felt, you know, when I was in those villages, there was a lot of tension. The two young Sandinista Mezquitos who were my guides were not well received, but they had relatives, you know, so they were allowed to have me. There's only one village that refused to let me talk to them and, you know, listen to them. They speak English very well, most of them, but they talk among themselves in Mezquito, so you don't know what they're saying exactly. But they were grim. They were not very welcoming. And they said, well, you're an American, and what are you doing here anyway? And kind of suspicious of me. But what we didn't know at the time was that there really was a CIA plan that was later exposed. And to overthrow the Sandinistas. Basically, that was the deal. You know, they overthrew the government of Grenada, invaded Grenada mm-hmm. in 1983, and that was seen as a kind of practice for another Caribbean invasion, but of the Mosquito area, eastern Nicaragua, is really the Caribbean. It's black people and Mosquito Indians and Sumo Indians and very few, you know, western Nicaraguans. And so they look east and not west. And so that was like, well, this is coming next. So the Sandinistas, maybe they overreacted, but probably not. Because the CIA plan was to organize the Mosquitoes into a force to train them, you know, the ones coming over from Nicaragua. They had training grounds there. I later went over there, you know, not until 1985 could I get there. Would they let me out there, the Hondurans? But it was an armed camp, you know, with U.S. Military and CIA there, you know, doing training of the Contras. They were taking Honduran Mosquito Indian land for it, you know, which they resented. But so the Mosquitoes had a warlike, they have a warlike narrative in their, you know, in their mythology and their who they are as a people. Because they had fought, they were surrogates for the British fighting the Spanish. You know, there were all these wars in the Caribbean and Central America between the British and the Spanish. But there was this memory, you know, the Mosquitoes, which the basically the Sandinistas on the western side had no clue of whatsoever. They didn't know the culture and they didn't know this history. They learned it pretty fast, but they really got caught off guard. They knew they were Contras, but they did not have any idea they were going to use the Mosquitoes as, you know. But it did feel like, you know, when I went there, an armed camp, there were tanks, army trucks, and most of this is supplied by the Eastern Bloc and Cuba, not the Soviet Union directly, but the Eastern Bloc sending this equipment for war, for the Sandinistas to fight, because they had just been guerrilla warfare. They didn't have tanks or airplanes or anything mm-hmm. like that. They were totally unprepared for governance, so the Sandinista army was, you know, all over the place, and Mosquito people being displaced, and they have to be forgiven for a lot of mistakes because they were clueless. They had a lot of advisors come from all over the world, from all over South America, North America, Europe. I mean, really good people, you know, just helping build. Somoza had left no, there was no infrastructure, no road even out to the eastern part of the country. You had to fly. So it was, I was disturbed. I wrote up, when I got back, I wrote up a report and I had no intention of dealing with it further. But then you had Brooklyn Rivera. Well, he had left the country. He was the leader of Misdreavsata. He still is. And he and Stedman Faggett, who is, you know, kind of a wild card, but also charismatic. Stedman was the first one recruited by the CIA. And he liked the idea of going back to their, you know, the days they were fighting the Spanish and they were warriors. So it was easy to convince him. They would give them arms, give Misdreavsata arms. The CIA established these, you know, these refugee camps. They brought in evangelicals. You know, I'm writing this book on Christian white nationalism now, and one of the essays is going to be about this, because this was really when these evangelicals, these right-wing Christian evangelicals that were forming in the 1970s, were given this, you know, kind of free rein to go to the Atlantic coast and Honduras and to support that breakoff. When I would go into the Honduran airport, at the baggage claim, they would be unloading U.S. Army cases of weapons.
Wow.
They were just bringing into the Honduran airport to take out. I mean, it was all in the open. So that was a situation, you know, but people got very confused here. It split AIM completely because Russell Means really got recruited. This character named Ward Churchill really got hold of Russell. And so he hated communism. Communism was the worst thing. This was, remember, the Cold War. So,
yep.
Oh, man, you know, the anti-communist thing. And, of course, the missionaries had been just saturating the mosquitoes for decades against communism because Cuba, you know, was next door. And the Sandinistas were, you know, some of them were communists. Most of them were just national liberationists. But it was common in Latin America for there to be honorable communist parties. It wasn't like the United States. I mean, it was legal in the United States, too, but they were very suspect. So that was, you know, the big anti-communist thing. And I got dubbed a communist for... I was really trying to be neutral because I understood... I came to understand very quickly. I got a quick lessons and reading on, you know, the history of the Mosquito Indians. And I was sympathetic with them in terms of feeling alienated. They were, you know, they lived in deep poverty. Much of their land base had been taken away, and Somoza had been allowing settlers from the West, Spanish-speaking settlers, because he controlled so much of the land that it was very hard for peasants in the West to have a plot of land. So he kind of opened up, you know, here's free land. You can have a deed to this. So they were encroaching so much upon the Mosquitoes, and they were losing so much of their land base. And then commercial fishermen were taking away their economic base of lobster, diving for lobster. So they were under a lot of pressure, and I came to understand that very quickly. So I really felt I was on their side, but also supportive of the Sandinistas. But with the CIA involvement, it just changed the whole thing. There was no room for diplomacy and, you know, sitting down, talking, and working through things, real problems that existed, because the CIA was organizing this army based on their organizing of the Hmong that practically destroyed Cambodia and Laos. I met the CIA guy who had written that plan, one of those CIA agents like A.G. who turned against the CIA. Really a beautiful man, you know, very regretful for what he had done, but because he felt like he was responsible for, you know, genocide.
Roxanne is referring to Ralph McGeehee. Here he is speaking to Studs Terkel in 1983 about his tell-all memoir, Deadly Deceits, My 25 Years in the CIA.
The title itself tells your feelings, does it not? Deadly Deceits.
That's what the agency does. It is. It creates a lot of deaths around the world by its deception. And,
what do you call it, the CIA? You call it the covert.
Covert action arm of the president.
Covert
that
action.
Allows him to make foreign policy, to overthrow foreign governments without getting the approval of Congress, without getting the approval of the American people.
Casually, you said that, and overthrows governments. Uh-huh. That very phrase itself.
That's one of the most heinous operations that it conducted, that it used as a model in other countries, occurred in Indonesia. We decided we wanted to get rid of President Sukarno. His government at that time consisted of a 3 million man strong PKI, Communist Party of Indonesia, and on the right you had the military and the landowners. Well, in 68, some young military officers tried a coup against some older military officers. The coup failed, but the agency saw this as an opportunity to overthrow the government of Sukarno. As a result of that operation, that CIA operation, 500,000 to 1 million innocent people were murdered. It's a model to be used in other countries of the third world.
On that subject, here we are today, talking the year 1983, and you make reference to now Latin America, and there's El Salvador, and you have quite a bit of reference to that, too, as though it's almost a repeat, is it not?
It is indeed. I'm sure that the intelligence that's going back to the president is all justifying, you know, the policies he's already decided upon, as it was in Vietnam, where we're doing exactly the same thing, and in Nicaragua now, where we're trying to overthrow this very popular government with a very, very cruel group of people.
But he said it was the same plan. You know, I shared it with the Sandinistas, and that's what was happening, and they studied it then, but it just became an armed camp in eastern Nicaragua until they finally had a 1985 a constitutional convention of granting rights. So they had enough Miskitos and Sumos and Creoles who worked Contras to be able to negotiate a kind of autonomous zones out there, which they had never had, you know, and they didn't really want an independent country. They wanted their autonomy, their own language to be taught in the schools, which is reasonable, you know. The Miskitos in Honduras, you know, had, because Honduras had such a weak government, pretty well ran their own affairs and did teach in their own language. The language was much stronger there. They did not like hosting these CIA Contras at all. I was out there a lot with the United Nations Refugee Agency because they started building, you know, camps. They did come in, and they had been told in those camps that the Sandinistas had literally killed all their families. And I would tell them, you know, I was just there. You know, I know your brother that you're talking about. He's alive and well. And they didn't believe me. So what I did was I went back, and the Sandinistas cooperated with me to have Miskitos who were in the refugee camps in Nicaragua, because the fighting on the border, no one could live there. They destroyed all those villages in the fight, you know. And so they gave me permission to ask the people for letters to their relatives, send pictures. I took pictures of them, time-dated pictures. And then I would fly to Managua, fly from Managua to Tegucigalpa, and then take the, you know, awful planes out to those camps and show them those letters that their relatives, and they would be so happy their relatives hadn't all been killed. And then they would give me letters to take back with me to link. So this process, you know, over about until they stopped, you know, the army, the Honduran army, detained me and took me in. That was a pretty scary 5 hours of being detained by the Honduran army and seeing obvious CIA agents hanging around there and showing themselves to me. So I thought they were going to kill me, honestly. But it, you know, it was enough that they started communicating. You know, they were communicating with each other that there could be negotiations for their return. So, but it was the, you know, it was the division of aim that was so painful that I got called a communist. You know, Russell Means became horrible and his whole following, and then the Bellecourts, their following, it kind of split along the original fissure of tribes. And of course, the Navajos didn't know what the hell to think. And I took a delegation of Navajos down to see for themselves, to talk to people, and just stayed out of it, you know. And they came back and published in their newspaper, you know, pictures and saying this is all lies and everything. So it was a lot of work to make these links, but I really got targeted. And so So I was really burnt out, you know, by 1989. I have never gone back. I have never had a desire to go back to Central America, I have to say.
What is your advice to socialists or other progressively minded people who wish to take the cause of indigenous sovereignty seriously? And what does the Wounded Knee uprising teach us about the national question as it applies today in the United States?
Yeah, that's really the important thing that came out, that this was a nation. Wounded Knee, one thing it produced was a Self-Determination Act, you know, in Congress. Of course, there were some very important senators then, like Senator Arbogast. The Self-Determination Act in Congress gives Native people more autonomy than they ever had, but they still are under trust protection, which, if they weren't, it would be very hard for them to survive. They just don't have enough land base, because the land that was illegally taken from them needs to be restored. Mm. And the federal lands, so-called federal lands, those are all lands of Native people taken without treaty, just by the federal government. They cannot privatize it. You know, they're always wanting to privatize that land. They can't privatize it because they don't have the deed. The U.S. government doesn't have the deed to federal lands. They never negotiated. They just conquered it. So Native people want that land back. So land back is the main slogan now of really every Indian organization and all these Native scholars that have developed over the last 30 years. It's their number one thing, land back, every one of them. So that's the main thing, lawsuits, probably, future occupations. Wounded Knee was the beginning of that insistence of land back. Mm. The Sioux Nation 1868 treaty to have, there are ways to do it without hurting the settlers. There's ways to create, you know, non-inheritance. There's ways for the federal government to buy up land. They have some. After Wounded Knee, they have bought up some land for Standing Rock, expanded Standing Rock. But it needs to be done in waterways. You know, they cannot, even the Navajo Nation, so much of it is desert and mountainous and, you know, can't raise food, and, you know, the sheep economy is not self-sustaining. So they need to be able to develop their national economies. And I worked on that a lot also in the 80s and 90s, you know, economic, in the 70s, economic development things. And a lot has been accomplished, but it's still, you know, there's still enormous poverty, except on the casino, you know, and some of the casino reservations, mainly in the West Coast. But that, you know, the casino money has really helped, but the federal budget is always lacking in its support. And also just the kind of negotiations were taking place after Wounded Knee with Congress. And, you know, Nixon turned out to be, because it was a Democratic Congress that the Self-Determination Act he signed, you know, and most of those agreements, Nixon, as much as he hated the Indians and Wounded Knee, he signed these things. And so there is a lot more protection. Later on in the early 90s, there's also protection of sacred sites and also the Indian adoption. That legislation has been gutted by the Supreme Court, and there's a case up now that could wipe it out entirely. And this is for Native orphans must be placed with members of the family. If no members of the family come forth or can't do it, of some members of the tribe. And if not the tribe, if they can't get placed, to another Indian tribe. They have to have every step of the way before they can, because there's this awful adoption thing, you know, that was run by the Mormons and really in the West, and other places where they, you know, wanted to indoctrinate Indians, where they bought children from, you know, hungry, starving Navajos. So this, you know, keeping the children, being able to, Indian Child Welfare Act, that's what it's called, it'd be devastating if it went back to the way it was before. Because everyone, the main, when couples go to adopt, and now single people can too, they say what their preference will be, and they say Native American is their first preference. That's the first preference that people want to adopt, which these are white people. And I think it's really kind of sickening, you know, how that's kind of a throwback to controlling Indians. And some of the young people who've grown up as adoptees find they were not required to tell who their tribe was even, you know. And so the Indian Child Welfare Act put a stop to that mostly. I think it still happens some. But there's just very little possibilities anymore in Congress or interest in Native demands. So maybe we'll see another uprising.
Many thanks to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz for that discussion of the Wounded Knee uprising and its legacy. You can find some extracts from her book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, on the Jacobin website.
Long Reads is supported by the Star King School for the Ministry based in Oakland, known as the most progressive theological school in North America. Star King aims to educate the next generation of religious leaders through programs rooted in Unitarian Universalist values of justice, sustainability, and anti-oppression. To learn more, visit sksm.edu/Jacobin.